The views expressed on this podcast are those of the participants, not of Reuters News.
So it seems that some Chinese households are saying, well, you know, okay, property's down, but yeah, no, okay, it's not falling further. And I still got a job. And okay, stock market's quite kind of maybe attractive. So maybe I'll put some money in.
That was Harold van der Linde, HSBC's head of equity strategy for Asia Pacific. He sat down with me to unpick the shifting sentiment among Chinese households and implications for the rest of the region's capital markets. Welcome to The Exchange, a conversation with business people, policymakers, and experts around the world. We have seen an exodus of capital from Chinese stock markets, including Hong Kong. They've lost nearly $5 trillion of market value since 2021. Is the retreat temporary or something more permanent? And how is this pullback impacting other Asian markets? I'm Una Golani, Asia editor. I sat down with Harold van der Linde, head of Asia equity strategy at HSBC, to talk about the shifting fund flows. Harold, welcome.
Hi, Una. Thanks for having me on.
You're normally the one hosting the podcast, so the shoe is on the other
foot. On the Dominion Tree podcast, that's right. Yes, me and Fred talking about Asian markets.
Yeah, and it's a great podcast, but you know, we're here to put you on the spot this time, so thank you for joining us. I mean, I'd like to start with China, because that has really been the defining trend. I mean, the drop in Chinese equity markets is really quite extraordinary, with all sorts of implications across the region. I mean, just to start with, have we hit the bottom yet?
I do think we've hit the bottom, and I'll tell you in a second why. So first, the decline is because of, broadly speaking, two reasons, I would say. There's a technical sort of reason and a fundamental reason, if you want to put it in this framework. The first, the fundamental reason, is China is having all sorts of growth problems. The property sector, and it needs to reshift its growth model towards high-end tech. That takes time. That comes with a lot of uncertainty. How does that work out? And it means also that large parts of the economy do not get the support as they got in the past. So growth is slowing. That creates uncertainty. And that has caused a sell-off in the equity market. But there's another reason as well. And that is what we've seen. There's more geopolitical tensions, maybe. A lot of U.S. pension funds have publicly stated that they do not want to hold as many Chinese equities in their portfolios anymore. Some of them said, we're going to go to zero. Other ones have said, we're taking half of what we normally have. And they have also been in the market, presumably executing that, selling their exposure. So we've seen some really odd share price movements throughout last calendar year until early this year. But there seems to be a shift in sentiment now. We've seen new money coming back in. I have the impression that some of these larger pension funds have stopped selling. So we're in a stage whereby the sellers have stopped and early buyers are coming in. And maybe that sets the bottom in that market.
So that's really interesting. So sentiment is starting to improve. I mean, one of the things that has been happening up until now is that Beijing has been trying to support the stock market. I mean, it intervened much more forcefully in 2015 and 16. And at that time, I recall many stocks were suspended from trading too. The national team is at work this time as well, but it seems to have been less effective. Why is that?
I think the dynamics this time around are a bit different. So you're right. The national team has been moving into the market, trying to kind of provide some support for the equity market. What we've seen is that they're buying, doesn't seem to, it's always a bit murky what exactly they do and who it is and what they're buying, who they're buying. But it does seem that there was an initial providing a bit of support to the market. But the interesting thing is that was then taken over by two other investors. We saw Chinese hedge funds in particular coming back in, and also Chinese corporates repatriating US dollars that they had outside of China. So that provided some support. And from late February, early March onwards, we've also seen that foreign investors have started to come back into Chinese equities. And that's why I think that is a shift of sentiment, because those are, if you want to put it like that, if the central government buys, that's really because they think the market is selling off too much and this is a disorderly process. They're worried about this. But if foreign investors come back in, or Chinese hedge funds are coming back in, then that is kind of a natural process. So that's more healthy sort of buying, if you want to put it like that.
So when you sort of think about the efforts by Beijing to support the market and this repatriation of capital by Chinese funds themselves, I mean, at the end of it, how trustworthy are the price signals that we are getting from the stock market right now?
No, I think if I look at Chinese market movements and stock movements, I think a lot of it is price worthy, because this is a big market, right? There's a lot of money going around. And I know the Chinese government's got a lot of money as well, but it's not easy to say, I'm going to fix this market or something like that. That in itself, these efforts would already be negated by the market and saying, okay, we're going to really sell into that, see if you're really sure about this. So that doesn't really work. But if we look at, for example, movements in what happens in other markets, I see that being reflected also in Chinese equities. Now, if that market was really being set by the government, then that wouldn't be the case. So I think what we see in the Chinese market to a large extent is a natural process. What they've also done, and this is important, is that they've come up with regulations. They have said maybe it's good for Chinese companies to do share buybacks or pay more dividends. And they're putting new sort of plans, a 9-point plan in place for the next 10 years. They always like numbers, right? A 9-point plan next 10 years anyway. In order to support that the companies that list are of better quality, that dividend and share buybacks is more easier to conduct in China. So I think on a regulatory framework, and this is how you want to do that, they're providing more confidence to the market as well.
That's really interesting. I mean, I remember we went into 2024 and there were some really big, wild views out there in terms of how much Chinese markets could go up or down this year. So, I mean, moment, I think it's kind of not as bad as people thought. I think it was as much as 25-30% on the downside, as much as 20% on the upside. I mean, you've sort of talked about the measures that are helping to put a bit of a floor under the market at the moment, perhaps. But the real question, I suppose, is like, what will it take for Chinese equities to rebound? I mean, this is still the second largest economy in the world. Consumption, I think, is still pretty strong. So what would it take?
I think we need to see a couple of things for this sort of early recovery in China to becoming a sustainable recovery. People feel confident to buy in. What we need to see first is that the earnings are holding up. And funny enough, actually, we've just come out of earnings season. Now that's 2023 earnings. But if you take the property sector out, because the numbers, as you can expect, is all over the place there. If you take that out, you get about 15% earnings growth. If I tell that to investors, a lot of them are like, I hadn't expected that, actually. I thought it would be going to zero, maybe. I was happy if there was any growth at all. So that's one factor. So confidence in earnings is a little bit coming back. And you see the market also responding to earnings announcements in stocks a little bit differently now. Companies that come with an announcement that is positive, better than the market, you see that the market really pushes these share prices up. Sometimes they go up 10, 15, 20% or so. I think we also just need to get clearance that, and this will take longer, that, for example, the policies that they put in place to reshift China towards this new sort of growth model, that seems to be working. And it's too early to judge that. So that's something. I would like to see more on consumption. That might not necessarily happen. And I think also what would be good if we see an absence of what I can only say is called sort of surprise policy announcements that we've seen over the last 24 months or so. Just before Christmas, there was an announcement on the gaming sector that was then kind of negated within 24 hours. But that just didn't instill a lot of confidence to market participants. So we need to see that basically quieting down as well.
One of the other big potential game changers may be Chinese households. I think historically they still haven't put that much of their money into mainland equities and mutual funds, etc. I mean, is there any sign that Chinese households are ready to put more money into the stock market? Or can the stock market really push meaningfully higher without their participation?
No. First of all, we have to define which stock market we're talking about here, because you have Chinese stock markets, the Chinese companies listed in Hong Kong, the H shares, and that's more or less global funds where global investors mostly buy their Chinese exposure. And of course, you have then the markets inside China, the two biggest ones being Shenzhen and Shanghai. Now, those two markets are predominantly determined and set by, like, not just retail investors, like we're talking about hundreds of millions of retail investors. They control about 85-90% of that market in terms of total flow. What we've seen quite recently, last year, a lot of these investors were not eager to be back in equities, right? And it was painful for them. They bought a property, the property prices were down, they couldn't sell it. There was job losses and all these sort of things. Maybe younger ones in the family couldn't even find a job, so they had to support it as well. So the last thing you don't want to do is to dabble yourself in the stock market, which doesn't seem to be doing so good either. But also, again, since the beginning of the year, we've seen that total deposits in the banking system are coming up and that some of that money starts to come into equity. So it seems that some Chinese households are saying, well, you know, okay, property's down, but yeah, no, okay, it's not falling further. And I still got a job. And okay, stock market's quite kind of maybe attractive. So maybe I'll put some money in. So we've seen very early signs again. But that would be important. Onshore confidence needs to come back. And it's probably too early to say that that is happening. But we see early signs that that confidence is not worsening. Let's put it like that.
Yeah, I mean, the other interesting trend to me is that, you know, the Chinese stock market historically hasn't really been that closely correlated to the economy. Obviously, when everything is sort of the sentiment is generally negative, it's all moving in one direction, sort of down together, but or mm-hmm. slower down together. But I mean, how much does this stock slump really matter to the Chinese economy?
Well, there are two ways how this in a sense works. You're absolutely right. The connection between the stock markets actually across Asia and the economies is much weaker than in the US and Europe. So if you come from the US or Europe and you think about the Asian markets, you need to put that a little bit aside. And it's got all to do with composition of markets and these sort of things. But there are some issues in these economies that will make it difficult for some of these sectors and stocks to really run hard as well. One of the issues that China is really dealing with is oversupply. There's oversupply in... I would almost say, in which sector is there no oversupply? We have oversupply in banks, we have oversupply in property, in electric vehicles, in wind and other renewables. Most industries are dealing with significant oversupply, and that's not good. You can be a really good company and a really good management with a fantastic strategy, but if you're operating in an industry where it's just incredibly competitive, your profits are not going to do too well. And this limits that. What I spoke about earlier, we see that the earnings are holding up. But yeah, the question then is, can that continue? Now, maybe at a moderate pace, but there's always risk to these earnings, right? Because of oversupply, intense competition. Look at electric vehicles. China probably needs 7-8 companies that make each of them maybe 7-8 models. So you end up with 7 companies making 50 models from sports cars or big SUVs. If you look at Europe and the US, that's pretty much how these markets are structured. They got 80 companies making over 400 models. So we need significant consolidation there. That's maybe another driver for confidence in the longer run for Chinese equities.
Yes, but super complicated. So many different factors at work. What about the elephant in the room, the US Fed, right? So high US interest rates is often cited as a reason to stay out of China, or reason why Chinese equities are sort of, you know, exceptionally undervalued at the moment. But at the same time, you look across the rest of Asia, I mean, stocks are partying like it's 1989 in Japan. India has gone from expensive to more expensive. How do you think about the Fed and all of this?
Now, the Fed is remains, or at least what happens in US bond markets, remains probably one of the key drivers of Asian equities. If I walk into my into the office in the morning and I put my my screens on, the first thing I look at is actually what happened in US bond markets overnight. Where's the 10-year Treasury trading? In the past, they would say, how's the Dow and these sort of things if people would come in Asia. Well, first of all, the Dow Jones is not the index you should be looking at. It's the S&P 500 for more technical reasons. But you actually have to look at the bond market first, because that is the key driver for us. And yeah, we're now in a stage whereby it looks like maybe inflation is not going to come down as quickly as we initially anticipated. The narrative that earlier in the year, some people were saying maybe we're going to get 6 or 7 rate cuts by the Fed in 2024, that is now towards maybe it's going to be 2, or some people are saying maybe there's going to be a rate hike. So the narrative on that front is changing. That means interest rates are not going to come down as quickly. Yes, that means that the bond yields remain high. US 10-year bond yields have moved higher. That's just not good for Asian equities at all. It means a stronger dollar. Effectively, the way to think about this is that it makes a lot of sense to keep your money in the US. So you sell your Asian exposure and put it in a deposit in the US and get a nice, decent return there. That takes the fizz a little bit out of some markets. You're right. India, for example, where valuations are high. In Japan, there is a separate story. It's not just bond yields and yen that drives it, but also corporate restructuring. So that helps it a little bit. But even the Japanese market is not able to withstand the recent, attractive, the money flowing back into the U.S. bond market. Even the Japanese market is not withstanding it. It's come off to a certain extent. But there are some other stories in the region that provide a little bit of support to their local markets, given the headwinds that we get from the US.
So maybe you can just tell us a little bit about where we can drill into some of those individual stories. I'm actually dialing in from Tokyo, and certainly, like, the big question here is, you know, is it real this time? Because, you know, we've had false starts in the Japanese economy before, but just where generally, like, where are investors underweight and overweight?
At the moment, most investors are very, let's start in Tokyo, where you are. They are global investors. Asian investors are small overweight on Japan, and global investors are about neutral. Now, that doesn't sound as if they're really optimistic, but they were really, really underweight quite some time ago, and underweight for a long time. So getting back to neutral is already a big step. Can they buy more? Yeah, they probably can buy a little bit more. So they've really upped their exposure to Japan over the last couple of years, and that's because the weak yen is good for exporters and the corporate governance changes that we spoke about earlier on as well. Where they then move to is actually the rest of North Asia. We see that foreign funds are increasing their exposure towards China. That's the sentiment change that we spoke about earlier on. They're still very underweight, but less underweight. Unfortunately, they have all started to do that by the end of February, early March, at about the same time. So that meant that the market moved a bit higher as well. So, it's like you're trying to catch something that's running away from you. So they've increased their exposure, but the market has run up. So they haven't really closed that particular gap yet as much as they've done in Japan. Korea is in the spotlight. A lot of people are overweight on Korea because there's talk about corporate governance changes as well. Now, we can talk about if that's going to be real or not, but the excitement on corporate governance changes in Japan has then, you could say, spilled over. People say, oh my God, it worked in Japan. Well, it's going to work in Korea as well. So people have built some exposure in Korea for that reason. And Taiwan. Taiwan has been on fire since the beginning of the year for a very simple reason, that some of the major listed companies there, the founders and chip makers, just having a phenomenal good year. So a lot of the exposures to those markets. Now, funds are always over India, but that's been almost like a law of nature over the last 25 years. But they are quite limited in their overweight position at the moment, quite small. So against their own history, you could say they really reduced their exposure to India to a certain extent. And then ASEAN is a bit all over the place, but given that most of the money goes to, say, North Asia at the moment, it means that ASEAN exposures has really come off a bit.
Yeah, for Japan story, I think it's sort of really interesting because as you said, investors are still underweight, and yet you've passed these sort of milestones. You're trading above the 1989 levels. Kind of had a long-awaited end to negative interest rates. Decades of deflation perhaps seem to be over, and there are a lot of structural tailwinds that you talked about. Like, this is a big shareholder value push from the Tokyo Stock Exchange, and the regulators are sort of forcing companies to be more receptive to M&A. It's quite powerful, but you know, it does look like a lot of the gains are coming from the large caps, and that push for change will be harder elsewhere. And then you sort of throw the yen into it. I mean, people here are asking, is the yen, you know, it's currently like 155 or something, somewhere around there. And, you know, will it go to 160? Will it go to 200? Or will it appreciate? And I think that's the really big sort of unknown here, right?
Absolutely. The yen is a bit of an unknown. So earlier on in the year, the feeling was, hey, the US is going to cut interest rates. The yen is going to raise it, the Japanese. So it's not as attractive to stay in the US people are going to put money back into Japan, and the yen is going to strengthen. That's not good for the larger exporters. So that will take the fizz out of the equity market. The thing is that, as we said earlier on, now the Fed is off the market saying, well, maybe the Fed's not going to cut interest rates. So money's moving back again. So the yen has weakened, and that generally is positive for the Japanese equity markets, because, again, there's a lot of exporters that benefit from that. But we still think that at the end of the year, we're going to get a reversal, that the yen is going to strengthen a bit. Maybe not as much as we were looking for in the beginning of the year, but somewhere closer towards 145. So that is maybe more likely. And that could take a bit of a fizz out of the Japanese markets. But for the moment, it's moving in the opposite direction. And, well, you're there, but I got nearly all of my colleagues who are going on holiday to Japan, because, well, it's a great place to be on holiday, but also it's really much more affordable now.
I mean, they have record levels of tourists in the country at the moment. Very, very visible. I mean, people say Japan is cheap. I would say it's less expensive, but it's a really sort of interesting dynamic for Japan, because obviously a weak yen brings lots of benefits in terms of exports. Well, in theory, it should bring lots of benefits in terms of exports and tourism, but it's also it has a lot of negatives for Japan, right? You know, it hurts them in sort of supplementing their labor force. They've got a really real shortage of labor here. And, you know, for people in Japan, I mean, 30% depreciation of the yen over a couple of years makes going on holiday overseas very expensive. So I think that's going to be really interesting. And I think it's exciting to see if Korea can replicate or emulate a little bit of what Japan is doing. They've sort of, on some level, they've gone a bit further. They've kind of proposed this Korea Value Up Index, which will have all the top performing funds in it. And that seems like a promising development. And, you know, I mean, if they can even get some of the way there, that will be really, really interesting. So, yeah, I mean, lots of things to watch.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to throw a little bit of cold water over it. Not too much, but it is correct that they're doing good things and a lot of good suggestions come out. But there is also a difference between Japan and Korea. In Japan, you got these large keiretsus, which are large conglomerates, like Mitsubishi, and you got a bank and you got an auto company and a component company, but sometimes also a healthcare company, a life insurance company, and they all collaborate. In Korea, I have that as well. They call it the chaebols. But the difference there is that these chaebols are much more like a pyramid, and on the top sits a family. So ultimately, the decision makers, much more so than in Japan, is not corporates that cooperate, but it's really the family. And it's, of course, they do whatever is in their best interest. So we need to see that they are willing to buy into this particular sort of move in Korea as well. That's going to be shown in action. So we'll see how that's going to play out. So it's early days.
Yeah, well, let's see. I mean, I think more big picture, I think one of the things I'd like to finish on really by asking you is, do you think this deeper diversification of funds across Asia, maybe partly because of what's happening in China, do you think that's here to stay regardless of what happens with the Chinese economy and the Chinese stock market?
I think it probably is here to stay, and I hope it is also here to stay. 5-6 years ago, we were in almost an opposite situation. The market in China was rallying. You had large cap stocks that were really big and large and liquid and growing fast. And a lot of people said, why would I buy anything outside of China? I just buy these large internet names and I get China exposure. That's it. I don't need anything else. And the markets, some of the stock exchanges have publicly stated at the time that they were worried that their stock markets might get marginalized, that people would look at it. That is not now happening. Now we also see that there's a growth, still small, but there's a quite a fast-growing sort of asset class of emerging markets, ex-China sort of funds, whereby people say, we're not going to do China, we'll do that in a separate fund. But there's demand for that. People say, well, I don't want to be in China, but I want to be in emerging markets. So the nature of flows, the structure of these flows is changing. Japan is more interesting. Markets are responding, like Korea. India is a fantastic story, also probably for the next couple of years. So we have much more diversification in Asian equities. And as an Asian equity strategist, that's fantastic, of course, because you need somebody to talk about all these markets. And that's what I love to do. So otherwise, it would be just that people want to talk about one market. Yeah.
I hope it's here to stay too. It makes my job as Asia editor more fun as well. So,
absolutely.
Well, thank you, Harold. Thank you for joining us. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much, Una, for having me on. And great to talk to you from Hong Kong with you there in Tokyo.
Thanks for tuning into The Exchange. This podcast was produced by Katrina Hamlin in Hong Kong. You can find more episodes on Apple or your favourite podcast app. Check us out at breakingviews.com and on Twitter.
I'm Kim Vanell. Join me every morning for a roundup of what's happening at home and around the world. From the front line in Ukraine.
Extraordinary how these people adjust and even laugh when you take cover.
To the heart of US politics.
When Trump said that he expected to be arrested, it seems like he was trying to get ahead of the story.
We bring you everything you need to know in 10 minutes. For your essential daily briefing, follow Reuters World News wherever you get your podcasts.